This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
Welcome to the podcast. This week, we are excited and thrilled to have a very fascinating and interesting guest. His name is Mark Cuban. You probably know him as the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, or if you watch ABC's Shark Tank, he's one of the sharks, or if you're at all a fan of internet history, you'll know that in 99, he sold Broadcast.com to Yahoo for $5.7 billion with a B, and then immediately, or as soon as he was allowed to, collared his share of that in order to protect himself from what he saw as a popping bubble. And that turned out to be a very savvy move. When the market collapsed, it didn't hurt him at all. He took his proceeds at the time, bought a Gulfstream, bought the Dallas Mavericks, made a bunch of other investments, and proceeded to live large. And the conversation we had with him was really absolutely a delight. I'll let you in on a little secret. I wanted to get his book, to have him sign it for me. Every one of my guests, I bring books for them to sign. And I couldn't get his book delivered in time. It only comes direct from a publisher, and the Kindle wasn't going to do me any good. So I was scratching my head and trying to figure out what can I do to have him sign. And I was a huge Entourage fan, the HBO show that Mark Wahlberg produced. And he had a starring role in it as one of the people behind the alcohol Avion. It's Avion Tequila. And my office is around the corner from a liquor store. I ran over there. They had a bottle of Avion. And so when we were done with the interview, I said, by the way, I have something for you to sign. I pulled it out. And I wish we had the tape running because he just started to crack up. Hey, no one's ever asked me to sign Avion before. This will be the only bottle I'll ever sign. And I don't know if that's true, but I have the bottle sitting in my credenza in my office with his signature on it. He was absolutely charming and a delight to speak with. He's, you know, a rarity in modern times. There's no holds barred. He says exactly what he thinks about Ayn Rand, about gay marriage, about legalizing marijuana, about the SEC. Ask Mark Cuban a question, and he tells you honestly what he believes the truth to be. Very refreshing, not the sort of thing we see amongst billionaires. It was really a fascinating conversation. So rather than have me continue to babble, without further ado, here's my conversation with Mark Cuban.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My guest this week is Mark Cuban. You should know who Mark is, and if you don't, let me give you a brief introduction to his extensive curriculum vitae. He's probably best known these days as the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, or if you're a fan of venture capital investing and television, he's on Shark Tank on ABC's, which has been on since 2009, a very successful show. Mark, welcome to the show.
That is literally the best introduction I've ever heard in my entire life.
It's certainly the best one I've done in the past 10 minutes, to say the least. So, you basically left high school early, a year early, went to University of Pittsburgh, and subsequently transferred to Indiana University. I want to go over some of the things you did as an entrepreneur as a kid, which is really quite astonishing. So you, at one point in time, asked your father for some money because you wanted to buy a fancy pair of sneakers. And one of the guys playing poker with your dad,
probably drunk out of his mind,
told you to do what?
My dad said, you know, those shoes in your feet look like they're working pretty well. If you want new pair of sneakers, you need a job and you can go buy them. And I'm like, Dad, I'm 12 years old. Where am I going to get a job? And one of his buddies popped up. It was their Thursday night poker game. It was just happened to be their turn at our house. Said, I got something for you. I got these garbage bags I need to sell. Why don't you go out there and sell these garbage bags? Garbage bags.
Like in a big roll, like an industrial.
Actually, it was a box. It was a box, right? And they were just flat. And they were 100 for $6 is what I sold them for. And they cost me $3. So I made $3 a box. And I literally would go door to door to door. Hi, does your family use garbage bags? And who could say no? I mean, and that's where I learned to sell, literally. Every objection. Of course you use garbage bags. And I bet you pay more than whatever it is, 100, 6 cents a piece. And so I went on from there.
That's amazing. So you did that. Somehow in the middle of your education, you became a disco ballroom instructor.
It wasn't ballroom. It was pure disco.
Pure disco.
Pure disco.
So you were a disco dance instructor.
I was a disco dance instructor, but I only taught girls.
Right.
And I only taught preferably in sorority houses, preferably minimum of 10 girls at a time.
So this had nothing to do with making money whatsoever.
Oh, it had everything to do with making money, but I had, because I was looking for the person I was going to spend the money on.
There you go.
But it was $25 an hour. 25. I would do that
back
job.
Back in what year?
1979.
So that was real money.
I would do that job today.
At 25 an hour, the phones will light up. I bet we'll get you plenty of business. So you graduate Indiana, and you say, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life in Pittsburgh. I'm moving to Dallas. Yep. Fun, son.
Money and women.
Money and women. That's what's going on in Dallas.
All my buddies were down there, and they're like, you got to come check it out. We're having a great time. I moved down there. There were five guys living in a three-bedroom apartment. I was number six. There were no beds left, no rooms left, so I got the floor.
Crashing on the couch.
Yep.
Oh, not even on the couch.
Not even on the
floor. And you joined a company as a salesman, which, if memory serves, was called Your Business Software.
Yep. It was one of the first PC software stores. And I went in there, and I had not a recruiter, but just one of these services that were out there back then. And he sent me over there. And one of the first thing they said, look, we can't afford to pay for the service. Are you willing to go around it? I'm like, I just need a job, a real job. And I hadn't worked in technology at all. I really had done very little.
You had no technology background.
Minimal, right? Taking like one class in college and really just tried to teach myself basic programming. Mm-hmm. But he goes, okay, I've got one question to ask you. Customer comes in and they have a software problem and you don't know the answer. What do you do? I said, well, that's easy. I open up the manual, I read it, and they figure it out. He goes, you're hired. And that was it. And that was the start of my technology career.
So you're there for a year or so, not even?
Not even. Yeah, maybe 9 months.
And shortly thereafter, you get fired because you said, I'll open the store later.
So it was a retail store. And Barbara Depew, who I'll never forget, she went on to work for me, was working with me. And I was like, Barb, I've got this deal. I've got to close. Would you come in, open the store, sweep the floor, right, clean, make sure it's open, ready to open? She's like, sure, because I'm going to make some money, my first big commission check. Go to the boss and told him what I'm doing. He goes, no, you need to be here to open the store. His name was Michael Humecki. And so I used my first executive decision. And I figured, well, look, when I bring in a check for $15,000, $1,500 commission for me, he's going to be thrilled to death. Fired me.
On the spot.
On the spot.
Done.
Took my check. Didn't give him the check, right?
Right.
Went back and got the customer and started a company called MicroSolutions.
So that was your first company. And which, by the way, I'm going to tell people, was your first big sale. You sold that to CompuServe.
Yep. Remember CompuServe?
A couple years later.
Yep.
For $6 million.
It wasn't just a couple years. It was 8 years, 7, 8 years later.
1990.
So, yep. Yep.
So now there's a gap in your CV between 1990 and 95.
94. Yeah, 95.
I'm assuming that some of that $6 million was spent in ways that we won't talk about.
Actually, I started and sold a couple companies, including a hedge fund in there. But I partied like a rock star.
I can imagine.
Oh, my God.
You're 24. You got a couple of $1 million in the bank.
Oh,
and
I was making
period.
Money, right? Because this is back when, the market's so much more efficient now in terms of information and number of people throwing money at it. I literally would have some of the biggest names in hedge funds calling me every day asking Art Sandberg, Lee Ainsley, all these guys that own Maverick Capital, and you remember Art, would ask me questions about technology. And I was like, wait, I know more than you guys. I'm going to start trading stocks. And so just based off of all the things I knew from Your Business Software and Micro Solutions, I started trading stocks and did so well. I was making 80%+ a year that we started a hedge fund. And then within less than a year, it got bought.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Mark Cuban discussing how he sold Broadcast.com to Yahoo for almost $6 billion. This week, be sure and check out our podcast extras, especially this week. Mark Cuban goes off in our podcast extras. He discusses the SEC, what it was like to be the target of one of their prosecutions, how satisfying it was to be vindicated, and why he thinks the SEC is an agency run amok. That's on our podcast extras. You can find that at Bloomberg.com. and at Apple iTunes. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My guest today, the famous and infamous Mark Cuban. Earlier, we were discussing some of his early accomplishments and business sales, but you started a company in the mid-90s called AudioNet.
Right.
Ostensibly for the purpose, I want to get this correct, of broadcasting Hoosier basketball games.
It's not Hoosier.
Yeah, Hoosier. Hoosier basketball games.
Hoosier
I know
daddy.
That's a pet peeve.
Hoosier daddy.
Hoosier daddy basketball games. For people who were interested in hearing it, mostly for alum and other folks who may not
just
have
anybody,
had access.
Just anybody, right?
Right.
So basically back then, it was 1995 and the internet was new to everybody and the concept of multimedia or streaming over the internet was unheard of.
Right.
And so
audio on demand just did
nothing,
not exist.
Did not exist. Not at all. Not nothing. And so a friend of mine had a friend who said he was trying to get a way to list to send scores and information on beepers and pagers and stuff like that. And I'm like, look, that's the wrong way to do it. Let's start a company that tries to figure out how to put audio online. And so nobody was doing it. So we had to go out there and figure out how to make the whole thing work. And so I literally, to get started, I bought a Packard Bell computer, put it in the second bedroom of my house, bought an ISDN line, hooked it all up, went to the local radio station, KLIF, that did sports talk radio, and we told them that I don't know what this internet thing is going to turn into, but there's going to be multimedia on it at some point, and it could be like cable. Who knows? And this could be the way to go worldwide. Would you let me take your radio feed? And so we bought an eight-hour VCR. And a VCR that had supported eight-hour VHS tapes, connected to a board just like we have here, took the output in an RCA jack, put it into the VHS, the VCR, recorded it. Then we went back and figured out how to encode it, put it on a server that's in my second bedroom, and then we put it on a site called AudioNet, and I would go on to every online forum, AOL, CompuServe, whatever, and tell people you got to check out this site, AudioNet, and tell me what you think. And it immediately blew up. People went nuts.
And were you doing anything other than Indiana basketball?
Well, no, it wasn't even Indiana basketball.
So it was just what was coming from the local radio station.
It was from the local radio station called KLIF Dallas. And literally, we would take an eight-hour VHS tape and then put it into
8 hours worth of broadcast radio.
Right, just like we're doing here, right?
Right.
So we take the output of what, like we have here, put it onto a VHS tape, take it, put it in a VCR at my house, put it into my Packard Bell PC, encode it there, and then stream it. It was a horrible way to stream it back then, but when it was on demand, and so when anybody wanted to listen, they'd have to download the player software and click
right.
and listen. But people fell in love with it because if you were from Dallas or interested in Dallas sports or Dallas news,
anywhere,
this is the only way to connect.
So there was no other real audio on the internet.
Never
back then.
Anywhere.
This was the first
concept. This was the first guy.
So as much as people have made fun of Yahoo paying, what, 100 times sales?
The only people making fun are idiots, right? Because
this was really way ahead of its time and enormous potential.
Well, so there's two elements here. One, what were we doing, right? There is so little that YouTube does today that we did that we didn't do. Pretty much the only difference, other than obviously quality because of broadband and higher speed processors, etc.
But those pipes didn't exist back then. You were way ahead of the curve.
Well, it was even more than that, right? So, I mean, we were doing indexing so that we would take the live feed and do audio to text so that you can then go to index.broadcast.com and search for what did Rush Limbaugh say or whatever, right?
Right.
We would have internet radio stations, on-demand radio stations. So if you wanted all Elvis, if you wanted all
So you were an early Pandora, in other
words. Spotify, all ahead of that. We
mm-hmm.
had CDs and songs on demand. We actually helped the group Matchbox 20.
Sure.
We helped break that group, you know, by putting it out there and getting them out there for the very first time. Then we did the same thing with video. As video started to happen and we evolved from AudioNet to Broadcast.com, we went and did a deal and actually bought back then what would turn into be 10% of Lionsgate Studios.
Sure.
And so we would take their shows and we would stream them. So all this video we would put out there. And then we bought a company called SimpleNet,
mm-hmm.
which allowed us to do user-generated content uploads. So we were doing uploads of user-generated content in 2000.
Long and, before YouTube came along.
So
from 95...
And one last thing, right?
Well, right.
Our revenues, we did at least, I don't remember the exact number, but I think our last quarter was $23 million we did in revenue, and we were cash flow break even. So we did close to $80, $90 million for our full year as a public company, or almost full year as a public company, and that's in $1999 dollars.
So how did AudioNet become broadcast.com? How did that domain?
We bought the domain for $8,000.
Get out.
Yeah, but that's a lot of money.
That $8,000?
Yeah, because who else?
You know that half. You know that someone in Yahoo was saying, should we buy these guys? What do you think? Is this audio and video stream? Well, they do have the domain broadcast.com.
No, that's not,
all right,
okay.
Throw an extra billion
no,
on
no,
that.
Okay, so just all kidding aside, I probably had bought along the way trying to figure out ways to connect audio and video to different domains, standalone. So things from like policescanner.com to final4.net I owned, to sandwich.com, to baseball.com, to football.com. I owned all
really?
These amazing.
Do you still have any of these domains?
Yahoo's had them and sold them.
Oh, it was part of the transaction.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's worth $5.7 billion.
Come on, don't give me a hard time. Look, if you want to
do
it,
do you
talk
think
valuation,
I'm giving you a hard time?
Yes.
No, no.
That's
you're
okay, though. That's
no,
okay.
No, no. You're completely misunderstanding what I'm saying.
Let's put this
anytime
way.
Anytime you have the opportunity to sell any sort
of
company,
unless you're Snapchat, you're
for $5.7 billion. Dollars,
you do it. You don't think twice. That's a given.
Right?
Let's look at the valuation, right? First of all, we got it in stock. Right, we didn't
which
get
you
cash.
Immediately spent $20 million to wrap a collar around.
I had to wait 6 months to do it, but then
to do the collar.
Right, because there were certain ways I had to follow all the laws. Right.
Right.
But more importantly,
so by the way, for the listener, what a collar does is essentially locks a price in by using options, and so even if Yahoo stock subsequently collapses from $250 down to $18, not that that's going to ever happen.
Which it did. It went down to five, right?
Right. You're locked into your price.
So it's not like they paid us in cash. But more importantly, we had 80% of the streaming market.
That's huge.
Yeah. What was that worth? Don't think in terms of dollars per user, because the number of users back then was nothing.
But the growth was going to be exponential.
It already
we knew
was
billions of people
we were
coming
online. We were doing more. So if you took for inflation, we probably did more 5 years in than YouTube did. You know, YouTube wasn't doing $100 million in $1999, whatever that translates to.
So two quick things before we run out of time for this segment. You immediately do what was called the biggest online transaction.
Yeah, right.
You bought a Gulfstream.
Yep, online.
Right
yep.
away. And then within a few months, you buy the Dallas Mavericks.
Yep.
We'll continue our conversation with Mark Cuban talking about what life was like being a young upstart NBA owner and what it was like turning around really one of the laughs of the NBA, one of the worst placed teams really underperforming and taking them to a championship.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My guest today is Mark Cuban, owner of HDNet.
TV, we changed
Access
name.
TV. I keep calling it HDNet.
That's okay.
The Dallas Mavericks, a number of different properties.
Landmark Theaters, Magnolia Pictures, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about, look, you're probably best known as the Maverick owner who sits up in the stands with the fans.
Yep.
Let's talk a little bit about, I know you're sick to death talking about the Mavericks, but there's so much stuff that's so fascinating. I would be remiss if I didn't point out a couple interesting things. First, I didn't realize this. You bought the Mavericks from Ross Perot.
Junior.
And you also did some early transactions with him in some of your early companies. And any coincidence to that? Or
yeah, totally coincidence. And it turns out, when I had Micro Solutions Pro Systems, Ross Perot Senior, they couldn't ever make the local area networks. My first company, Micro Solutions, what set us apart, we were one of the first three companies in the country that did local area networking integration. So back then in 1983 and 84, no one thought about hooking PCs together.
Right.
So by 1988, we were probably, we were the largest IBM local area networking integrator in the country. Apple came out with local area networks. Ross Pro was a big integrator with Pro Systems, and they couldn't make it work. So they brought us in to make it work. So that was my original connection, but that was Ross Pro Senior.
And then this was just a coincidence. So you buy in 2000, you buy the Dallas Mavericks. Let me just explain for people who may not be a Hoops fan how awful they were.
Yep.
The 20 years prior, they had a win-loss record below 40%.
They got voted the worst professional sports franchise of the 90s.
It's unbelievable. In 1998, 2 years before you bought them, they were 20-62.
Yep.
That's just horrific. The year you buy them, they go 53-29. They make it to the second round. In 2006, they make it to the finals,
only to lose
to the Heat. And it looked in the beginning of that series like you had a shot.
We did have a shot. We kind of got tushy-tapped, to say it politely.
But to be fair, they were a phenomenal team. You were an up-and-coming team.
I wouldn't go that far.
Come on. They were a really strong team.
When one player goes to the line on an average more than the other team,
right.
Yeah, there's something wrong.
But, you know, there is no shame in losing to that 06 Miami Heat team.
Hey,
they were a really
solid in the NBA. There's one winner, and everybody else is tied for last place.
So let's go to 2011. You get your revenge.
Yep.
You get to play the Miami Heat and actually win.
Yep.
And you were just overwrought with emotion. I remember seeing you on television, and it was just
emotional about it.
It was wild. It was really, as a fan. Look, I used to sit in section 205 and watch the Knicks play when it was Charles Oakley and Patrick Ewing, and I actually just passed Anthony Mason on the street the other day. He's still a monster.
Right?
Yeah, no, you can't miss him. And you know, the thought of an owner sitting in the stand with fans is just astonishing. So the first question is, what did you do to turn the Mavs around? Because you took them from worst to first.
So when I took over the team, it was January of 2000. We were 9-23. And the general manager and coach at the time, Don Nelson, who came from the Knicks, actually, said, you know, we can lose and try to get a good draft pick and da-da-da-da-da. As it turns out, it was one of the worst drafts ever. And I'm like, no, at some point, this team has to learn how to win. So we focused on winning, and as it turned out, we had a nucleus of a great team, and people just didn't expect us to win, so the players didn't expect us to win. And so I walked in and said, I expect you guys to win. We're not going to mess around anymore. If you don't lay it out, if you don't put it all on the line, I'm going to trade your ass. And, you know, guess what? This is going to be a premier destination in the NBA. You can laugh because that's what everybody did, but I'm going to kick everybody's ass. They just don't know it yet.
And you had Dirk from the previous year?
We had Dirk, Steve Nash, Michael Finley, Sean Bradley.
That's quite a core to build a team around.
Yeah, everybody thought, I mean, we literally couldn't trade Steve Nash. They had tried to trade Steve Nash before I got there, and they couldn't do it.
That's
amazing.
They couldn't
trade Michael Finley. They didn't try to trade Dirk yet. But yeah, it was crazy.
Now, people who are in Dallas say going to a Mavericks game is not like going to any other basketball game.
Yeah, I really try to make an experience. I mean, the thing about going to a sporting event, it's the one place where you can scream and yell and have fun, and that's all good, and we expect you to do that.
Unless you get fined.
Well, that's me, right? Everybody else can do whatever they want, and I try to make it like a good wedding. You know, it's memorable. You don't remember the scores. You don't remember the jump shots.
You just remember you had a great time.
Yeah, and you remember who you were with and why and all that kind of stuff.
So I don't want to spend too much time talking about the fines,
uh-huh.
which every time you get fined by the NBA, you do a match charitable deduction. But there was one thing that stood out, and I have to ask you about, because it's almost like an urban legend. So at one point in time, you called Ed Rush, who's the league's manager officials.
He was, yeah.
Hey, he couldn't manage a Dairy Queen for a day. And then subsequently, the folks at Dairy Queen said,
"Come on,
hey, it's harder than you would imagine."
And I did.
Actually managed the Dairy Queen.
Yeah, it was probably the best PR thing I've ever done in my life. You know, it just
people
out,
lined up for.
Oh, I got there at 6:30 in the morning, and there was a line a mile long. There was helicopters. And look, it wasn't me. I got to give. There's a guy named Paris Chapman who was a local Dairy Queen franchisee. Smartest guy in the book when it comes to marketing, because he turned it into a circus, benefited his business.
Sure.
And it helped me too.
And the urban legend was that Warren Buffett sent you a thank you note,
which he did.
That's unbelievable. That's a fascinating story. Coming up, we continue our conversation with Mark Cuban discussing his venture capital investments and how he became one of the stars of Shark Tank.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My guest today is Mark Cuban, famed trader, investor, star of the ABC television show Shark Tank, which really has been building up a lot of momentum and has generated a lot of buzz, and now it's really getting killer.
It
took a year or two to get it ratings, but it's blown up.
Well, actually, before I was on. No, it's amazing how big the show has gotten. It's the number one show in all of television watched by families together.
And really?
What I didn't get, when I went on as a guest shark in season two, I think, was I thought, okay, this is a business show. I'd watched it. I'd liked it. I'd yell at the TV, don't do that.
Right.
And I just thought that was it, right? Maybe I'll get a good deal. But I go on and I do these deals, which actually turned out to be my worst deals I've done on Shark Tank. But then all of a sudden, I start getting you know, emails and comments from people on the street. Love the show because my 7-year-old loves to watch it. My 12-year-old now understands valuations. We talk about businesses. We, you know, when you see some, you know, a family from Iowa standing on that carpet on Shark Tank talking about the company they started as a family, it makes kids realize they can do it too.
That's really fascinating.
And it's so aspirational. And so not only is it kind of a new age lemonade stand where it encourages people, but it also gives them examples of others who have done it. And it's the old saying, you know, if they can do it, I can do it. And that's literally what's happened.
So you started out as an entrepreneur. You know what it takes to make a business work.
Yep.
Now you're looking at new entrepreneurs. Let me ask you a few questions about what you think are the most important things. So when you're looking at an early stage investment, is it the person, the idea, the cash flow, or the valuation? What matters most?
Idea, execution, vision, person. Because they all go hand in hand. Everybody's got ideas, so that ideas alone are worthless. You've got to be able to take it from an idea to a business, which says something, right? You took it to the first step of execution. Then what's your vision? Where can you take it from there? And do I believe that you can get it there? Those are the key elements.
So who do you end up investing with most? Meaning, what other shark do you seem to co-invest?
Oh, I try to avoid them all.
Is that what do you think of the people you co-invest with?
You know, as investors. We're all smart. We all wouldn't be there unless they have some level of intelligence, right? Each of us have different skill sets. So where it plays to my strengths, it's technology, marketing, whatever. Then I pretty much take control of the deal, and they can have some of the economics. I don't care. But I would say probably Barbara. I like working with Barbara the best because Barbara's always got a unique spin on things. Mm-hmm. Lori's not bad. Lori, because she can put things through QVC. But I would say Barbara.
So that's a built-in marketing outlet for a retail.
Right. But
you've had
limited...
some tech sort of products come along.
Sure, I've had all kinds. I mean, I'm up to like 50 deals. I've done more deals than
Shark Tank.
Just from Shark Tank and including season 6 and stuff that hasn't aired yet. But I've done more than all the other sharks combined.
Really?
Yeah.
And you never seem to do more than $1 million. They're all small.
No, I've done a $1.7 million. There'll be one. I've done $1.5 million.
What's the average?
I don't even know.
But they seem to be half millions.
So what happened early in the show, the first couple seasons I was on, the deals were 50, 75K,
yeah,
right? And now last season, and in particular season 6 that we're in right now, the deals are, you know, 250 minimum for the most part, 500K, 750, multi-million deals. So they've gotten a lot bigger. The companies are a lot more solid than they were in the past.
More developed, further along, more mature.
Yeah, because people recognize the value of getting on the show.
Well, even if you don't get an investment, someone sees it. There's marketing value.
Oh, yeah.
You're attracting other capital.
There's going to be 12 million people that watch you within the first week of airing. Then it's going to repeat on ABC at some point. You're going to get a lot of PR. And any entrepreneur recognizes that. It's part of our job actually being up there. I call them gold diggers, right?
To
separate the gold diggers from the companies who really need support.
Right. Do you still do a lot of VC and angel investing outside of Shark
Tank? No question about it, yeah. But
Shark Tank is just for fun and...
Well, Shark Tank sends a message, right?
Mm-hmm.
I do Shark Tank. The deals are good and I enjoy it. But to me, the importance of doing Shark Tank is more sending the message that the American dream is alive and well. There's no other platform where... whether it's in school, whether it's on television, there's absolutely no other platform where you can go out and reach kids and families and entrepreneurs and encourage them and support them and train them and really fire them up and give them some guidance to go ahead and start that business.
And that's fascinating that families are watching the show together more than any other show.
It's amazing.
That's an astonishing data point.
It's crazy. I mean, parents walk up to me just to brag about their kids watching the show. It's the new age lemonade stand. It's how you learn about business.
So let's talk a little bit about some of your public investments.
Sure.
You've been pretty public about the stuff you've looked at. You happen to mention Netflix.
Right.
I think you said 150,000 shares plus options.
It was 50,000 shares I bought plus I'd already sold previous to that, I don't know, 100,000 plus puts.
You had sold puts, so you're hoping somebody...
Well, I said if it craters, I'm happy to own the stock. And if it goes up, I've taken in premium.
Now, walk us through the thought process.
Sure.
Are you looking at Netflix like you're making a venture investment in a company because you like their long-term perspective as a business and you don't care about
the
price?
You've got to look at the big picture, right? So within a macro positioning, there are no more small IPOs.
That's right. Certainly not lately.
No, and that will go back to the SEC, right? They crushed the IPO market. And so without the IPO market, there's not a big risk of companies come up to bang on you, right? There's no broadcast.coms. There's no, 2004 Googles, right? It's so hard to go public that it's going to be very, very difficult for up-and-comers to knock off an incumbent, which I think Netflix is.
So in other words, the SEC rule changes for allowing all these pre-public private investments, now all these companies are capital-rich?
No, it's not even that, right? So put that in your the pipe, right, and we'll go to Netflix first. So in the bigger picture of things, if you look at the whole entertainment environment and you say, what is the most disruptive force in media today? Netflix.
No doubt about it. The estimates are at night it's 25% of internet traffic.
More now, right?
Crazy.
And so I hadn't always looked at Netflix that way, but what's happened now is that all the pipe companies, right, the Verizons, the ATTs,
right,
they've all invested so much money in infrastructure that delivering Netflix, they can do it now. You're not getting the buffering like you used to. I mean, there's still some, but it's not nearly as bad. So all the infrastructure is there for Netflix. And so that's part one. Part two, there's nobody who does what they do at the scale of what they do, at the price of what they do. There's others that are coming in like HBO Go. There's others that are coming in like CBS.
Right.
But those, there's Hulu, but those are more on the fringe, right? If you look at Netflix with, 40 million, whatever, 50 million global subscribers and ask, okay, if they can get to 50 and they're just starting to grow international, can they get to 100 million? Yeah. Can they get to 500 million? Yeah, because CBS, HBO, they're not all of a sudden going to entrench themselves.
Right.
Now then you look to the flip side of that. What is the impact of all that on content and entertainment? Already today, if you wanted to create a high-end show, you don't go to HBO and ask for an output deal like you would have 10, 15 years ago. You go to Netflix. When CBS wants to start a new TV show, when Access TV or Magnolia Pictures or 2929 Entertainment want to do a movie or a show, we go to Netflix to see if the money is there that they want to participate with us, right? Netflix.
Now, years ago, you would have gone to a network or a movie studio.
Right, right.
Now, it would have been bypassing that.
Used to be that Showtime and HBO said, okay, 10% of the box office, we'll give that to you, right, in exchange for the rights to the movies. That's pretty much gone. So now Netflix, in essence, subsidized the whole content industry. The whole, and that's extending to the global content industry. Mm-hmm. Now, the short sellers say, well, that's an $8 billion hickey on their balance sheet of, in some respects, undocumented or off-the-books liabilities. I look at it and say, everybody needs Netflix really, really bad to survive, and they both need each other. Right, Netflix needs all that TV content to be created and put on TV because it's a cheap source of content and gives them breath. And every major TV show on television, whether it's cable or broadcast, needs Netflix to subsidize them. Movies look for Netflix to subsidize them. So that symbiotic relationship is going to allow Netflix to grow.
And they're locked into the infrastructure of
the infrastructure's already there.
Entertainment and media. And
yeah.
Nobody else has access to...
It's not that they don't have access. What Netflix did that was brilliant, when they really got going,
From DVDs to streaming.
What they did in ARB, right? That was the most brilliant ARB of all time. So up until Netflix really started to push, it would be, okay, if I want to sell on iTunes, if I want to sell on Amazon, if I want to sell anywhere, I got a commission. It was basically on consignment.
Right.
If I sold it for $15, and look, I have movie companies, right? So one of my first movie ever greenlit was Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room. So if I sold a DVD of Enron and I got my 40% or whatever the margin was, okay, great. And I didn't know how many I would sell. Well, and then I might have some other content from Access TV or wherever, or 2929, that was just dusty.
Right.
Netflix said, you know what? We know how we're going to market that. We know how we're going to get money. I'm going to write you a check up front. We're going to pay cash up front. So it was an ARB. My cash versus how much revenue I can create using your content. And they made it work. They marketed. Their marketing was brilliant and their subscribers grow. And it created a dependency.
Thank you, Mark. We appreciate you spending so much time with us today. This week, be sure and check out our podcast extras. You can find them on iTunes and at Bloomberg.com. And I really mean... This week, be sure and check it out. Mark was nice enough to hang out with us for an hour after the broadcast portion was over, and we discussed everything from his continuing interest in picking up a Major League Baseball team to a deep dive into his experiences with the SEC, some of which were absolutely hilarious. He had us cracking up in the studio. If you've enjoyed these sorts of interviews, check out all of our archive of previous conversations. You can find them at iTunes or Bloomberg.com. My daily column shows up every day at BloombergView.com. And you could follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Welcome back to the podcast half of our show. I'm Barry Ritholtz, and my guest in the studio tonight, we're recording this Monday night, is Mark Cuban. You're in town for a handful of
NBA meetings.
NBA meetings. What is that like when you go to an NBA meeting? Are you, like, well-behaved? Are you
the renegade in the
room?
I'm the renegade
like,
still.
Like, what is Mark
no, no,
do
no,
tonight?
No, it's actually the opposite. Mark, you're going to talk about this, right?
So all these guys who are too proper.
Don't want to talk about it.
So on the down low, it's like, hey, here's what you got to do.
And things have really changed a lot since Adam Silver came in.
Right.
Because guys are a little bit more comfortable with Adam. David was a little bit firmer.
You had good things to say about him.
I like David. Don't get me wrong.
I know there was a little headbutting.
Oh, no, there are things we disagreed on, but I respect and like David.
He did a great job. He was a great ambassador for the NBA globally.
He was a hero for us, but just the approach is a little bit different. Adam's a little bit lighter, and David's was a little bit not I wouldn't say formal, just more. What's the right word? David had his way of doing
structured,
things.
Structured, rigid.
No, it was just he had his opinion. He was opinionated in his own way, and he wasn't as open to disagreement.
Okay, well that goes on.
Which is why we batted heads, but respected each other.
Well, we see how that sort of disagreement has worked out in the NFL these days.
Yeah, it hasn't helped them at all. Right?
And you've been pretty outspoken. I'm sure you're tired about talking about that by now. But the NFL had a couple of issues, and they just never really dealt with it right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was saying is that when you're building a business, you're climbing up the mountain to be the best, it's one set of skills.
Right.
And when you're there to stay on top, it's a different set of skills. And it's really, really easy when you're on top to feel entitled and to feel like you're invincible. And when that happens, you know, pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered, and it's a recipe for disaster. Now, they haven't had disaster yet, but it's not like people haven't had second thoughts about the NFL.
They've certainly taken a PR hit. You know, we go through that same conversation with people who spend their whole career accumulating assets, and when you say to them, all right, you got to take a breath, you're no longer in the asset accumulation business. You're in the asset preservation business.
Yeah.
That's a mental transition that people have
tough.
A hard time to
and,
make.
You know, part two of that is everybody's a genius in a bull market.
Sure.
Right. The NFL has gone through a very much a bull market because of fantasy sports, because it's a great
cable,
football.
Everything.
Right. So, I mean, you go back 20 years, there were teams leaving in the middle of the night.
Right.
You know? And so, look, they deserve all the credit. Jerry Jones is, I really look up to, you know, in terms of
Isn't
sales.
Isn't that stadium awesome?
Unbelievable. It's literally the eighth wonder of the world.
When we, last time we were in Dallas, we went to a game just to see the stadium.
And a lot of people do.
It's brilliant. It's really a brilliant
amazing.
Stadium
And he's got
design.
Balls of steel to have, you know, put himself on the line like that. So Jerry deserves a ton of credit, but, you know, it's difficult. And the reason I know that they have problems now is because you saw Roger Goodell out front and you didn't see a single owner out there with him.
So they just let him flap in the breeze. The first rule of holes is stop digging, and he doesn't seem to want to stop digging.
Well, it's a little bit different because I'll give you an analogy. Growing up in Pittsburgh, right, you were talking about the Mets. Well, up until the last 2 years, everybody would say, why don't you buy the Pirates? Why would you buy the Pirates? And I said, because they're not for sale. Well, he'll right price, they'll sell it to him. I said, look, here's why they're not going to sell. If I told you I would pay you $25 million a year to stand right in the middle of the city of Pittsburgh and have every single resident yell at you 24 hours a day, would you take that $25 million a year? Everybody will take that.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, so if I told you I'm going to pay you $44 million a year to stand in front of the media and take the bullets for all the NFL owners, would you take that job? Yeah, and that's what Roger Goodell's job is. He's taking the bullets. He's the one saying, it's my fault, it's my fault, it's my fault. And, you know, it's working now because they, you know, they haven't had any issues, but it's going to, you know, things are going to be happening. Things will happen, and it'll be interesting to see how they respond.
Fascinating. So now let's talk a little bit about The Mets, that's not going to happen.
Not
right?
going to happen.
Not going to happen. We get you and David Einhorn together.
Make hey, you a, know what? Now with Bud Selig retired in a couple weeks.
He wasn't a fan of you, as I
no,
understand.
No, he hated me, and I wasn't a fan of his.
And once he's gone, any chance you buy
him? No, I doubt. No, you know, if the Mets came along, I wouldn't buy him by myself because now that I have three young kids, it's too much fun spending time with them.
My engineer, Charlie, says he'll go half with you on,
done.
On the Mets.
Done.
There are a lot of people who would love to wrest control of the Mets.
Absolutely, right?
From they really have.
But it's the same
well.
Thing. I'm sure they're making money. If they weren't, they would be sellers.
They did a phenomenal job renovating. That's another really nice stadium.
It's
Everybody
beautiful.
Loves Yankee Stadium, but the little secret in New York is Citi Field is actually a nicer place
and
to
it's
see
not
a
such
game.
A little secret, right?
It's
just Met fans are always pissed off when they go.
Yeah. The problem is, it's a beautiful place, but you got to go watch the Mets. I grew up a Mets fan on Long Island, and long-suffering the Knicks, the Mets, it's just really been
I hope your suffering continues because they play.
So let's talk a little bit about, we discussed earlier, your investment in Netflix.
Right.
Let's talk about some of the other more, what's the right word to use? Disputatious, ceremonial. Let's start with short selling.
Okay.
All right. I'm a big fan of short sellers.
So am I.
I think they've done a great job rooting out fraud over the years.
Yep.
One of the first podcasts we did was with Jim Chanos,
yep.
who tells unbelievable stories about, you know, working his way through balance sheets.
Oh, of course.
Like, how this kid.
Oh, I remember.
Can't,
look,
this
can't
Jim
be Chanos,
right. To Enron is a perfect example.
Yeah, Enron. I mean, I did Enron, the smartest guys in the room, the movie, right? But prior to that, the broadcast.com days, I remember sitting there with Enron and them trying to sell me on bandwidth plays, you know, and I'm like, how the hell are you going to transport bandwidth? You know,
right.
How are you going to create an efficient market? And delving into them and think it was crazy. But in any event.
Smartest guys in the room. You're not as smart as them. See, if you were smart as them, you would have known how to arbitrage
exactly.
bandwidth.
No, I love short sellers. I used to make a killing in selling short because, you know, back in the day when I told you I was running this hedge fund, because I knew if equipment didn't work, if back then Synoptics put out a router, you know, or a switch, I knew because I had to install those things if it didn't work and if it was going to sell because I had to sell them.
Right.
And so I would short sell, you know, just by nature of understanding the industry better than most people. And that's why I would have all these hedge fund guys, you know, get in touch with me. So
calling you and asking.
Yeah,
you.
So I've always been a huge fan. And then when we got to broadcast.com and it went public, you know, at that point in time, we had the largest one-day jump for a stock of an IPO in the history of the stock market. Mm-hmm. So there was a huge short position, obviously.
Everybody was covering.
Well, not even, no, because it was an IPO. You're not even, to this day, you're not. So the IPO was the biggest one day. But after that, the day you were allowed to short, everybody shorted every share they can get. And people, you say, aren't you mad at short sellers? They're shorting your stock. I'm like, are you kidding me? I love short sellers. Because if my company's going to do well, all they're doing is creating, you know, pent-up demand
right.
for the
There's
stock.
There's a natural floor. There's
right.
short sellers who actually stop the collapse by covering.
Right, because they have to cover if you do well. Now, if you're a fraud or your company's horrible, you deserve what you get, and
right.
your stock's going to zero at some point anyways. Doesn't matter what the short sellers do.
So I don't know if anyone's ever asked you this question
uh-huh.
quite this way, but when you sold broadcast.com uh-huh. to Yahoo, were you aware that we were in the midst of a bubble, or was it?
Absolutely.
No, this is just a whole new thing.
Oh, no.
Like, this is a bubble. I'm ringing the bell. I'm done.
No, I mean, go back and read the articles from back then. So, two things. One, I didn't sell for cash, right? So,
it was
like
stock.
Yahoo stock, you have to remember, was.
It was on fire.
Right. And their market cap was higher than it is today, you know, 15 years ago, much
right.
higher. I mean, it was like in the hundreds of billions.
Right.
Right. And so, for us to take 300, I think it was, we got 28 million shares of stock at $350 a share or something. I remember exactly. So, when I hedged, and it was called one of the top 10 trades of all time by whatever magazine.
It's a pretty damn good trade.
Right.
Right.
But when I hedged.
What was the average price of Yahoo around then?
Oh, it
was.
Would
you hedge in there?
I don't remember.
High hundreds, low 200s?
Well, actually, when I started to hedge, the price kept on going up. And I had told everybody that I had hedged it. And there's a clip from David Faber on CNBC mm-hmm. where he says, don't you feel stupid now that you've hedged this and Yahoo's gone up another $100?
I just made $1 billion. Well, how stupid am I going to feel?
I said it's hard to feel really stupid flying
right.
around in my G5, right?
Right.
But back to why, right? So
that, by the way, that's an attitude of using money as a measuring stick instead of thinking of money as a tool to be deployed for other purposes.
Well, it goes both ways.
What'd you pay for the Mavericks?
$285.
All right, $285. Had you not hedged, you would have lost that window. You would not have been able to take
that. And it was funny,
that.
Back then, the stock price of Yahoo would go up $30 in a day. And I was like, I just paid for the Mavericks in one day.
Right.
I just paid for my plane. But you asked, what was I thinking? You know, I've been in this business a long time. And so in the 80s, I saw the PC stocks go straight up, straight down.
Right.
Then I saw the software stocks go straight up, straight down. Then I saw the local area networking stocks go straight up and straight down.
There's a pattern there.
Yeah. Why did I think that it would be any different this time? Because there was always a hot technology area.
And this was internet software, and that was just a matter of time before
it was just
that
a matter of time
over.
For internet to get with the
And your job isn't to top tick the market on your exit. Your job is to say, if I can lock in $1 billion, I could do a lot
with
that.
To this day, I stay hedged. So I use a DVOL tail hedge type thing that Credit Suisse put together for me. So I've actually made money as the market went down, took it off after I got to a certain level.
Right.
And you know, hopefully the market will keep on going up. And if it goes up much higher, I'll put it back on again.
So you're always running with insurance.
I'm always running the hedge because the market never makes sense until after the fact.
Right. Everybody's got perfect vision, 2020 hindsight.
Right.
It's always perfect that
exactly.
way.
Exactly. So, you know, it used to be, okay, interest rates are going up, the market will go down some, right? You know, oil does this, the market will do that. And there were all these correlations that everybody understood. Now the market's gotten so complex that nobody really understands. It's almost like I've had my biggest trades up until recently in currencies, because currencies are more transparent than stocks.
They're very liquid.
They're liquid.
Amounts trade every day.
Well, but even more importantly, you've got the central banks telling you exactly what they're going to do.
Right.
Right? There's
not that hard to figure that out.
No, and you know exactly what's... Now, they get heavy, right, with everybody, and then you've got, you know, when everybody comes out. Now, in hindsight, it's easy to see. And one of the reasons I put on the hedge, because I thought this could happen, I just didn't know when, because everything now is so interrelated, once... When people start piling into the same trades that everybody's doing,
right,
whether it's currencies on one hand, it's treasuries on another hand, then you've got all the momentum stops, the GrowPros, the Netflixes, you know, who else just has blown up, right? All these stocks, everybody dumps in, and with margin at 1-2% or whatever it is.
Right, next to nothing.
Yeah, and you're thinking, well, the dividend's higher, so I can go into Apple, but... That all works until something in the whole series takes you down and it delevers everything, right? Because then a hedge fund gets delevered. Then when one hedge fund gets delevered and the stock goes down, someone else wants to meet their benchmark.
Right.
Then the day trader gets pulled out, and even though that's a smaller percentage. Then the hedge funds want to freak out because they're going to lose all their upside for the year. And so they're getting called
in. They want to lock
in. Right, and they're getting called in because of their margins because they were levered up. And so now there's this cascade until you get to the bottom, and you never know really what that is. And then people that start creeping back in to buy again.
So you mentioned complexity in the markets.
Yep.
Let's talk a little bit about high-frequency trading.
Sure.
I know you're a big fan.
Yeah.
You're in algorithmic trading. You have a whole row of servers set
up. Absolutely.
So here's my complaint about HFT, and I'm curious.
Sure.
Because I found, doing a little research on you over the past few weeks, I found you and I are pretty simpatico about a lot of things. We disagree about a handful of things, but we'll get to those. So my problem with HFT is simply this. Trading is a zero-sum game, and if someone's jumping in front of grandma's mutual funds trading,
that's wrong.
Whatever the HFTs are making, that's coming right out of grandma's retirement account.
Yeah, in terms of transaction costs, absolutely. Right?
It's black and white.
And I agree with that, but that's less of an issue to me. Mm-hmm. What's more of an issue is there's no such thing as bug-free software.
So you think this is adding instability and danger
to the
system?
We've seen freezes. We've seen the flash
crash. Well, clearly the flash crash. And we saw what effectively looked like a bond flash crash.
Right. And it was.
Like in an hour, not even, in about 10 minutes, the 10-year went from 2.3 to 1.9
back up in 2 seconds, right?
That doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
We used to say that that was a fat finger, but we know it's
fat
not.
Thumb.
Right, yeah.
Right, that was purely computers arguing
Computer arguing. So did you ever see the movie... where do you want to play a game of thermonuclear war with Matthew Broderick?
War games,
right? And it was like two machines talking to each other in a simulation, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then the simulation turned real, and then they had to go back door and say, hey, Joshua, you want to play a game of chess, right? High-frequency trading is no different. It's an ongoing interaction between algorithms from competing sources. No one is giving anything up to anybody else and saying, well, I'll share the pie. They're all trying to be smarter. Literally, if you wanted to destabilize, now they've, with, when they put the, whatchamacallit, the, not the thresholds.
The circuit breakers.
Circuit breakers in, that's that made it more protective. But still, if you want to destabilize, you start with currencies and, you know, let's just say I'm a nation, an enemy nation, right? And I just give one company $5 billion, another company $5 billion, another $5 billion. I'll just let them trade normally for 18 months, let's say, so everybody trusts that there's just normal.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, I just start hitting one thing that I know is going to impact and correlate to another because I've looked at the data. Here's a correlate. And then when that gets hit, I start hitting that one. And then when that gets hit, I start selling that
so
one.
So someone, if they want to, could totally disrupt our economy.
The market, right? Not even necessarily, but individual stocks. But currencies or whatever else, treasuries, everything else where there's not circuit breakers.
You know, one of the most interesting examples of how high-frequency trading algorithms manifest themselves, people have used examples of some odd book for sale on Amazon, and there'll be two algorithms offering to sell it, and they'll get into a war game situation where the price of this nonsensical book that nobody cares about, nobody wants to buy, suddenly it's $2,000 for sale used on Amazon.
Right.
Because somehow these algos got into a loop with each other and they just keep raising the price on each other.
In less than a millisecond.
And suddenly a book nobody's buying, nobody cares about is $3,000. It's insane. You're in favor of a Tobin tax, transactional tax.
Yep.
So let's call it this way. If your quote isn't going to exist for more than a second, you pay a penny or so.
Not even a tenth of a cent. Some amount. Right.
And what that does is that gets rid of the spoofing, that gets rid of all this
or even
nonsensical stuff that has nothing whatsoever to do with anything.
Okay, so look, there's a battle between people who think they provide liquidity and people who like that because they're traders, and then there's investors.
Right.
This market is no longer a platform for investing. We don't talk about investors anymore. They're the puppets, right? They're the sock puppets that sit out there, the Muppets, that just get taken advantage of, or maybe they put their money in their 401k and they hope that those big guys don't. The reality is this is a platform for hackers. Who's got the best technology? Who's got the best software to try to make money? We are long gone from the days where you said, you know what? I like Netflix. You know, I like Apple.
I could buy this and put it away for a few years and not worry about it.
We're the schlubs. The people who do that are the schlubs.
So let me give you the two counter arguments.
Sure.
Which these aren't coming from me. I'm quoting other people.
Sure.
But there's something there that I find kind of interesting. First, sitting in your seat a few weeks ago was Jack Brennan. He's the chairman of Vanguard, little shop running $3 trillion. And he said, we love anything that reduces our costs of execution. And we're buyers and holders. We're long-term investors. And there's a big advantage for us to be able to go out and use these algorithms to find the best price for Vanguard shareholders.
Look, if you're a sniper like Vanguard is,
right,
and there's nothing wrong with that, it helps you, right? But it's still, all you're doing is saying, you know what? The market is such a mess. I need to be a sniper.
Yeah, right?
So the grocery store truck crashes on the street.
Right.
And I'm picking up the eggs, you know, at a discount.
Right.
You know? And so I don't blame him for doing it.
That's his job. That's what they're supposed to do.
But all he's doing is trying to make a sales pitch for Vanguard, which is cool because they're the low cost. And I tell people, if you're going to buy SPX index, buy Vanguard.
They're great.
But at the same time, if you want to be an investor and we want people to invest in the market and we want people to look, we want to start building an IPO market.
Mm-hmm.
There's no chance.
We want companies to come out. The whole idea of the original concept of a market
is to create capital for companies to grow.
So that's good for the economy. That's good for everybody across the board.
That concept is so far gone. Right. So in terms of a Tobin tax, what is it that's going to make people have to keep their stocks?
Make it cost more to do that sort of nonsense.
So you can't just turn it quickly. You have to invest in a real company.
Now that's, you know, your reputation is, hey, here's a guy who's a libertarian, reads Ayn Rand every 5 years, blah, blah. But some of the stuff you talk about is decidedly, I'm going my own path, and I believe that sometimes that's truly libertarian, right? I guess it is because I think
for myself.
So that's exactly right. So I was impressed with the Tobin tax because I wasn't expected. It's a perfectly valid solution for a problem.
Right. The whole key is this has got to be a market of investors to create capital for companies to grow. We're so far past
that. And that's what the original design of markets were.
Right.
It's a place where capital and entrepreneurs can meet and
we
build
the
backbone of a country.
And we're so far away from that. How many times do you see capital being invested in companies that needed to grow over the last month, 12
You know,
months?
If Wall Street was actually doing that, shows like Shark Tank, there wouldn't be a need for them.
Well, possibly. That's okay. I'm fine with that, right? But okay.
But
so
that just shows
you
look
at
how
Alibaba,
far. Right.
Alibaba didn't need capital. They didn't need $20 billion, right? You know, there's a couple on the margin, $25 million IPOs.
Mm-hmm.
But there's how many? I read recently that the number of IPOs from 1995 till now that raised under $50 million has dropped by 80%.
Isn't that true, though? The entire middle merchant banking market
gone.
Has disappeared because all the companies that were mid-sized companies, they've all merged or gotten absorbed
the question
or went
is,
up.
Okay, so what's happened, right? So this is one of the things that's killing the economy, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I start a company. And back when it used to be, hey, hopefully we can go public, I get some liquidity. And this also contributes to income equality, like Janet Yellen was talking about.
Right.
So back in the day, there were going to be 200, 300, 400 companies a year who, as they grew their companies, go public, could be, you know, on the small OTC, whatever, and raise $10 million, $15,
right.
$20 million. That gave them capital to have a chance to grow. Now that capital was gone. So they go out there and they get VC, angel money, and then if they're able,
giving up a lot of equity for that.
But that's okay because you would give up equity in IPO too.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't hit those initial milestones, right, you're going to have a hard time getting a Series A. But let's just say, for the sake of example, you've gotten to a Series A. Right. And so you've shown some success, and that's why people have given you a Series A round of investing. Right. So you're growing startup company. You've been around 2 years, just got it. What happens next? In the past, if you know, you did 50 million in sales, 75 million in sales, were going to be profitable, marginally profitable, you go raise $25 million in an IPO. Now, if you have that type of future, you get bought by the company you want to compete with. Which inherently means there's less competition.
Right.
Which inherently means instead of that company growing to be a competitor with Google, or just using it as an example, or Netflix, that company's bought.
They're absorbed.
Right.
They're bought pretty
right.
pretty early
less,
stage.
Yeah, fewer jobs. Right. Mm-hmm. Less competition. Right. Less investment in up and coming companies. You know how hard it is for an average investor to invest in up and coming companies that are public, that have any liquidity? It's impossible.
Huh.
And so because of all that, the economy hasn't grown nearly as quickly because there aren't – back in 1995, you know, we were doing our best to be profitable, but we knew that we could – if we showed any kind of a progress,
you had a runway. You had an option.
We had a chance to go public, right?
All right. So I'm going to be benevolent dictator, and I'm going to appoint you SEC chair.
Okay.
What does Mark Cuban, SEC chairman, do? How do you change the rules to benefit – the investor class and to benefit
really,
the economy
really,
as a whole.
Oh, really, really easy. So
hanging curveball? Is that a...
Yeah, it is a hanging curveball. But first of all, the SEC destroyed the IPO business because people don't want to go public today at all because of all the administrivia, right? All the
accounting, filing,
all that stuff.
All that.
And they have to do that now because the SEC was so asleep at the wheel, Congress felt like they had to create 1,000 new rules, right, in order to be able to protect companies because the SEC can't protect them. The SEC still can't protect them. They couldn't then, and they can't now. Now, what's the problem? First problem is the SEC is not about protecting investors. They don't give a shit,
right?
Because all they care about is how many cases are they going to bring so that more lawyers have experience so that they can go out and get jobs in the private sector, right?
But SEC, those are all pretty straightforward inside of trading cases.
Some of them are so ridiculous, but the point is.
We know a couple that are
totally.
Sort of ridiculous.
You put mine aside, right? It's been a year. It was a year ago this week, actually.
Okay, done, right?
Done.
Tossed out. You were vindicated court.
But it wasn't even a toss-up. It was ridiculous. But, okay, so let's go back to the SEC. You have no idea what insider trading is. Nobody does. There, if you
trading on material non-public information.
No, not necessarily. No.
So you're saying that black letter law definition.
That's not insider trading. So if you saw a guy get hit by a bus and you realize that was the CEO, that's material non-public information.
But that is public. He was hit by a bus.
Because there's only six people who saw it, right?
It was on 42nd Street.
Doesn't
that's public.
Doesn't matter.
It's if I'm going through the garbage can and I find. sheets from an eminent merger, hey, this is garbage. This isn't public.
Are you sure?
I'm cleaning up a law office.
Are you sure?
Actually, there's been some ambiguous cases about that as well.
I'll give you another example of the SEC and their stupidity. Guy was going to work at a railroad company, right? Go up, drive in the parking lot, and he saw all these limos and guys in suits getting out day after day, week after week, couple weeks. Figures, maybe there's an acquisition going on.
Right.
I'm going to buy calls. Had no inside information whatsoever.
He just saw the parking lot, which is in the public area.
They brought insider trading case against him.
Because he worked for the railroad. Did he win?
Yeah, he won, but it cost him a lot of money, time, and a lot
of
embarrassment.
A lot of headache.
The point, I'll give you, if you go on Google and Google Mark Cuban SEC video,
right?
So I did this. I had a meeting with the CEO of a company, public company, and we discussed everything but numbers. Right, because he was interested in one of my companies. And so a month went by, and we didn't discuss anything more. We never discussed any public, never discussed his numbers at all, only discussed my company. And so I was like, I like this company. I wonder if I can buy stock. And I never ended up buying it, but I called the SEC. I said, SEC, I told you just what I left a message.
I was talking to them about selling them my company.
Right.
Can I buy stock in their company?
So here's what
They've never disclosed anything about their numbers.
Nothing.
Just
nothing.
Here's all my paperwork, but we never got to them.
So I told them that, right? And so they called me back. I left this on a message. Mark Cuban, so they knew exactly who it was.
Yeah.
This is on my video. I did a video, a little phone video, right? And they said, you need to go to this page, right? This will tell you to get you a response. So I go to the page on the website. It's a mother page from 1980 saying you have to send your question in 7 parts and mail it to us and don't expect an answer anytime soon. That's how the SEC works. They have no interest in protecting investors. They have no interest in making the market a better place to trade and making it safer to trade. They have no
Would you do to change it?
So here's the problem. So how you change it? You create bright line rules. She talked that Mary Jo.
No ambiguity. Just
none.
This
boom.
Is allowed. Black
this
and
is,
white.
Boom. Right. And then where there's things that happen that you aren't sure, then you can litigate those.
Right.
But if you did that, you'd reduce the amount of litigation by 99% and nobody would have a job and the SEC Insider Trading Group would be 90% smaller. Because, look, they talk about the broken window policy that she wanted to create.
Meaning?
Mary White said, we want this to be a broken window policy. Mayor Giuliani.
You see, like back in the days of the Bronx,
right.
When you saw broken windows, you fix it because broken windows encourage crime.
Exactly. Right. So they wanted to do the same thing with the SEC. She literally talked about it when she took the job right around the same time I was going to trial for my
SEC. This is
a year ago.
Okay.
A year ago, Mary White. But the problem is, if I walk up to a cop in Brooklyn and say, Mr. Policeman, if I throw a brick through this window, is that against the law?
Of course.
He's going to tell you. If I go up, Mary White or anybody at the SEC, if I see someone get hit by a bus and I want to know if I can trade on it, is that against the law or not? There's no place you can get an answer.
Corporate counsel can say to you,
corporate counsel,
if he's hit on 42nd Street, you could do a purchase.
Do you have corporate counsel?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Do you know any, walk down the street in New York City and I walk up to somebody who we want to be an investor in
stocks. York City, it's about 50-50 if they have corporate counsel.
But still, you know.
But in most places, people don't necessarily have counsel.
It's
on
ridiculous
staff.
That the response to that question is call corporate counsel.
Okay.
It's ridiculous,
but
right?
That, and but even you understand you do, why that's the answer, right?
Yeah, because they want jobs.
All right, it's because I don't really know. I have an idea of what is and isn't.
No, you
but
don't.
But there's a ton of gray.
You think,
and
there
should be right.
And you can reduce that amount of gray
with some black and white answers.
It'd be so easy and so fast.
So right? What about the IPO market? What can they do to fix the IPO market to start a resurgence?
Well, part of the problem is it's already too late. For that, right?
Is it? That's it? That we're done? The IPO market is toast? Never to come back?
No, it's not. Hopefully that's not the case, but they fricked it up so bad,
right?
Because they are, you know, at your companies and your businesses and your jobs, you have goals. And when you set those goals, you evaluate whether you reach those goals, right?
Right. And it's very easy to set. If you can quantify it, you can measure it, you can manage it.
Right. So Mary White, the chairman of the SEC, says, we want to improve capital markets. We want to make them safe, right? So how do they measure that? Do they do research to say,
How do you measure that?
I do. Here, I'll give you, take a step back. Every time I give a speech related to the subject, I always ask the same questions. How many people have, how many people have not invested. How many people trust the stock market? Oh no, do you trust it? Here's what. Sorry. Do you
By the way, that number is going to be much lower today than it was 10 years ago.
That's what I said. Do you trust the market more today than you did 10 years
Absolutely
ago?
Absolutely not.
Nobody
Most,
does.
The average answer is, well, also keep in mind, they lived through the dot-com bust, they lived through the housing crisis, they lived
Whatever
through the
is,
credit
right?
crisis.
Right. Well, that's exactly the point.
Then
right?
high-frequency trading,
and
then the flash crash.
Where was the SEC in all those, right?
Bernie Madoff. Don't forget Bernie Madoff.
All these things, right? Bernie Madoff.
Yeah, they've had quite a few black eyes
oh,
in the past
huge,
decade.
Right? But how do they measure their success? They don't do research to
Conviction
say,
rate on insider trading cases.
Yeah, no, not even convention. The number, right?
The total
and, yeah, and how much money they've taken back, which has no relevance to whether people trust the market. Then I say to people, okay, has anybody here invested internationally in other countries? Have you?
Sure.
Okay, how many countries do you think?
Well, we use Vanguard to do emerging markets in Europe and Asia and things like that. So we're not out picking individual stocks.
But still, but you trust those markets, right?
I don't trust Russia. I know that's
But how many of those have you ever...
And I know that's one of the cheapest markets in the world
have
today.
Have you ever investigated the insider trading laws in any of those markets?
No.
Do you think Vanguard has?
Probably.
No, they haven't.
You don't think they have?
Oh, hell no, because there's hardly ever cases brought in any of them.
Why is that?
Because there's no relevance to confidence in the markets relative to insider trading. There's a lot of arguments that said insider trading should be legal because if
I've read those.
Because
I've
if a
seen
CEO
those.
Sells their stock, it sends you a message that
right.
is better information to the market than them not telling you that they sold their
right.
stock for 3 months or whatever it is, right? So the fact that people, and I asked that question, is anybody not invested in a foreign market? Now here, let me do another. Alibaba, biggest IPO ever.
Right.
Ever, right? If what is the guy's name? Xi, the head of the China, the head of the Chinese Communist Party,
mm-hmm.
goes to Jack Ma. Jack, how you doing this quarter?
And
Jack says, "This is my numbers exactly."
Right.
What do you think is going to happen? You think he's going to say no? It's insider trading. I'm not going to tell you. Hell no. He's going to tell him whatever he wants to hear, right?
For sure.
And you think the SEC, and here's the company in China. It's a freaking communist country that's the largest IPO in the history of the stock market. And there's no freaking way that the SEC can enforce any level of insider trading laws related to what happens.
Isn't that true for any ADR that trades here? Relative
Pretty much.
To,
Pretty
so,
much.
So whatever we're buying, Sanofi that's in Europe
the
or
point is,
Total,
the point, yeah,
anything
the,
like that?
The point is that insider trading law
can't be enforced.
It's not only that, but it's really not relevant in investor confidence, and they don't care.
So what has to be done to fix investor
confidence? You make it very bright line, right?
Right.
You be honest about what impacts the market, not just what creates jobs for lawyers. Because obviously people don't care about insider trading because we tell people to diversify, which is silly on its own face in a lot of respects, because people don't understand what they're investing in.
Mm-hmm.
And diversification means going to all these different markets which have no insider trading laws whatsoever.
That's really an interesting way to think about it.
And some of our biggest IPOs.
I haven't heard it put it that way.
And some of our biggest IPOs are in communist freaking countries where it is impossible. What are you going to go to the head of the Chinese Communist Party and say, look, sir, we need to subpoena you so you can come in and you know, we can take a transcript?
Are you kidding me?
I
love China's GDP always to the cent.
Yeah,
they know the day
like
the
GE's
quarter
earnings,
ends,
right? It's like GE's
bang,
earnings.
Right there. Well, back in the bad old days when Jack Welch had G Capital, they could pull a penny out anytime they wanted.
Right.
They were
so
precise.
So you get the point, though, right? So if you're really trying to be effective in accomplishing something, so the SEC has basically got to get out of trying to manage the and trying to do insider trading law enforcement.
Make it bright lines, black and white.
You've got to go back to Congress and say, you've got to make it bright line. Here's what's allowed. Here's what's not. Here's what we're going to let you do, and here's what we're not going to let you do, so everybody knows. Nobody has a clue.
How long do you think it's going to take for the public? You know, I used the 1929 example. You had the market crash in 29. The market didn't get back to break even till 1954. 25 years later, it was like a whole generation
Look,
of people had to be born.
And then from 1965 to 1982, it was
66
flat.
82, right.
Yeah.
So it took like a generation of people to grow up who didn't
and
know
look
about
look at the NASDAQ, right?
The
millennials are out of luck, and here comes the next generation.
Here we are. It's 14 years later, and we're still not back to the 2000 highs.
Exactly.
So
because the SEC, and part of that is the SEC. I don't care what they say, because we've had to go through Sarbanes-Oxley, and what was the last one that they haven't even?
Dodd-Frank.
Dodd-Frank, right, which have created so much regulation. They had the SEC going back to 2008 had this thing, I forget exactly what it's called, but it used XML, right, which is a scripting type language
right.
where you can pull data.
Right.
Now with big data, there's so many ways that if you had every single company file everything that they did and every share that was bought
and
sold.
You could really just automate the whole thing, right?
And look for outliers. And so there's a lot of ways that they can improve it rather than having the CEO have to sign their life away for everything they did. And that only happens because the SEC is full of morons when it comes to insider
trading.
So
you really think the SEC has damaged
this country?
The economy, the IPO,
all the above,
the small
because they are so delusional about what's effective.
Wow, that is really.
And you tell me what my argument didn't make sense.
There was nothing in there that didn't make sense. You mentioned China. I wanted to bring something up. You had said that I thought was fascinating, and you hinted at it in an earlier discussion. You said, "Do you think China is going to come walking over, fly in like they did at Pearl Harbor?" Which I thought was a joke.
No, it was. It wasn't. Yeah, that was.
It was a reference to Animal House.
Yeah.
Did we roll over when the Germans attacked us at Pearl Harbor?
What was I saying? It was.
No, they're going to attack us through cyber terrorists.
Right. No, that's what I said. Our Pearl Harbor, the Chinese are going to be our Pearl Harbor for cybersecurity.
So here's what I don't understand. You look at the U.S. electrical grid. It's absolutely wide open, unhardened. Anyone who wants to send us into a non-electrical period. It's not that difficult to do.
It's getting better. It's getting a lot better. But your point's well taken. The only saving grace is Russia and China. Theirs is even worse.
Right. So that's number one. Number two, there isn't a major company in the United States that hasn't had their entire computer network rifled through by the Chinese army.
I
mean, they literally.
It's not just the Chinese army, but it's also the Soviet, the Soviets, the Russians, all these kids that are sitting on computers that may not even have electricity the full day. That's their way to just use their intelligence and what they've learned. Look, the beauty of technology is that there's something new every day, and there's the person who created that something new, and there's everybody else, and everybody else starts at the exact same time to learn it, right? So nobody has an advantage. The smartest guy in Russia, the smartest guy in China, smartest guy in the U.S., other than the person or people who created it, everybody else is tied in their knowledge. And so it's just a question of effort to learn how to crack those systems and learn how to use them. And so people with all this time in Latvia and all these, Eastern European countries, right? That's all they do all day because the rewards are there. And in China, the military, they're doing the same thing. Us and Israel are basically the defense forces for that.
That's really astonishing. And now when you think about that, what does it mean if all this intellectual property, all this R&D energy, all this work that's been spent by all of corporate America is being pilfered by...
Well, I'm not so worried about that. I'm not worried about the IP being pilfered. I'm worried about it being destabilized in one way or the other.
That goes back to high-frequency trading and the algorithms.
All the above, right?
Anybody has the ability to do that.
Everything digital is a platform for hackers. It's just a question of the value proposition to them, right? So if Putin's going to put you up on easy street, wherever you happen to be, and move you to Moscow and your entire family, if you're able to crack X, Y, or Z, why wouldn't you do it, right? If you're in China,
your best opportunity if you live in Russia.
That's the new that's the new gold rush. Right, the new IPO, the 1999 gold rush IPO market is sitting in Russia from a technology perspective, sitting in Russia, some Eastern European country or China, and just learning how to crack, learning how to hack, becoming a hacker for your country. It's patriotic to them, right? And the same things happen in Asia, and the same things happening in the Middle East, right? Because the greatest return on your time to hit, the Mark Cuban type IPO type scenario is to crack somebody and hack somebody and do it for your country.
So what about in the United States, the NSA hacking everybody else in the world?
Different issue, but...
There are obviously privacy concerns.
Right, there's privacy concerns, and I've started companies around it. But you can't argue with you. We need somebody there protecting us. We need somebody being playing offense.
Proactive.
Yeah, someone's got to play offense for us. And
do
I'm
you
sure
think
that
the NSA has backdoors into all these other tools and technologies, or is that just a classic conspiracy theory?
I don't know.
All right, he's basically at an undisclosed location, unable to comment on that. You've said some really fascinating things politically. I want to talk about some of these. I mentioned a lot of the things you said really surprised me. I wrote a column a year ago about how McDonald's and Walmart's are welfare queens, that instead of paying a decent minimum wage, they pay these low levels and fob it off on the taxpayer.
Right, so it's taxpayer
subsidized. So you actually said, and I think it was to, what's her name? Cups on...
Essie Cups, on an interview.
I thought that was a really interesting interview. You said as far as the food service industry and retail is concerned, I'm for the minimum wage
going up.
Being increased to $12. Why are taxpayers subsidizing low-wage employees?
Yep.
Now, again, that's really not the sort of thing one would expect to hear from you.
Why?
It makes sense.
No, okay, when you think about what to expect from me, I'll tell you exactly what I do.
It's perfectly rational.
No, what I do, I say, what's the problem?
How to fix it.
How do you solve it?
Right.
That's all I care about, right? And that's what we've lost in politics today.
For sure.
People don't want to fix problems. They want to have their dogma incorporated everywhere, right? And so, look, I would love it so that the government wouldn't have to do anything. It'd be brilliant if we
but
could do
But that's not going to happen.
It's not
going to
happen because, look, if you're 500 pounds, if you're 100 pounds overweight, you got to lose the first pound before you can lose the 99th pound.
Right.
You can't just stop eating and say that's a solution.
You think it's 100 pounds? I'm
no,
thinking it's
40,
like 20,
yeah,
30,
but, you know,
somewhere in that range.
But, right? Me too. And so that's the way the parties approach things, right?
It's dogma first, solution
right.
second.
Here's how you lose 100 pounds immediately. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
You've got to solve the problem, and it's got to be contextual and have a chance of...
So $12 minimum wage for fast food and retail makes sense in your mind?
Yeah, because people still have to eat. So it's not like it's fungible money, right? So you're going to eat somewhere. And if it applies to all fast food companies...
So everybody goes
everybody's
up
goes
There's
up
no
the same
disadvantage
way.
To anyone.
Right. And look, it's not like people... They can hire fewer people. They have to serve their demand.
Makes a lot of sense. Let's talk... Can we talk about your rivalry with Donald Trump?
Yeah, I actually like Donald. It's not really a rivalry. It's just that he's easy to pick on.
Well, you once said something to him. The quote that stood out was, I could write a check for your whole net worth and I wouldn't even notice it was missing.
Yeah, well, that was true.
Well, what sort of argument were you in the middle
of?
Oh,
no, because I had
Donald
to show
Trump.
The benefactor and he had The Apprentice.
Right.
And so he said my show was a knockoff, which it wasn't, but it was still poorly done. ABC, it was a whole other set of reasons. But,
right.
So, yeah. So.
Oh, so that started a little
back
and forth.
Yeah, it was just a PR, trying to create PR.
He's an interesting character.
I like Donald. I actually like Donald, but he's... When it comes to social media skills, he's got none, right? He's got no social media game whatsoever. So, you know, face-to-face, I love talking to him. Face-to-face, you know, just he's a smart guy. He's got, you know, he's been successful. He's been up, he's been down, and he's fought back, and I give him tons of credit.
The old New York joke about him was, you know, he made a small fortune in New York real estate.
Yeah, but he started with a large
one. Started with a large one, lost most of it, which is...
But when it comes to social media...
Not his forte.
Oh, no. It's just so, whatever he says, it's just easy.
So you offered him $1 million to shave his head.
Yeah, just
for
fun.
You donated for charity.
Yeah, just for fun, just because I like to mess with him.
And any response?
No, but again, I like Donald. People think it's this big rivalry, but I like him.
He's definitely a character, to say the least. Coming up next week on Masters in Business, Donald Trump. I don't think that's going to happen. This was, again, another quote. I love the concept, says Mark Cuban, of Obamacare.
Yep.
Not what one would expect.
Nope.
Clearly the United States healthcare system is a mess.
Yep.
And giving a lot of people healthcare through the emergency room,
which
was
work.
A Reagan-era law that was signed,
doesn't
make
it.
Any
Look,
sense.
We pay for healthcare one way or the other.
Right.
People aren't dropping dead on the
streets. And
we pay
for it the most expensive way you can.
Possible, right? And so the insurance companies had their chance to be efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And they had their chance to come up with better solutions.
No, they cherry-picked the best.
And they just never did.
Right. They picked the best risk and said we're going to ignore everybody else. So
Look,
they picked
we put the health of our country in the free market in their hands, and they basically said rather than doing the right thing, we're worried about earnings per share. They made a choice. They made a choice knowing that there was a risk, particularly when Obama came in, that if we didn't provide the right service, we were going to be at risk of being
pushed aside. This hasn't really hurt them because now they just got 40 million new insureds, which they're going to
They'll provide, but it was on a different set of terms. It wasn't on the
there's
same
no thing. More rescission. You can't just drop somebody because they got sick.
But now,
which is really a horrible thing they used to do.
Oh, it was ridiculous, right? What did I read at one point? 19% or 20% of claims are turned back initially. So people who are sick,
just to be
dying,
a pain in the neck.
Just to be a pain in the ass to try to, you know, hopefully people will get sick and not follow through, right? Which is horrible.
Yeah,
in this country, look, we make choices as a country.
Right.
We want to have transportation, so we have roads, and those roads are maintained. We want lights in those roads. We want
tell me
control.
If you find roads that are maintained.
Well,
I'd
not
like
well
to
enough,
drive
right?
On,
right?
On some
right.
Of them.
But air traffic control. There's things that we collectively agree to. Right. Health is one of those things. In order for us to be vibrant as a nation, we want to be healthy. Right. And the insurance companies just kicked the ball. They blew it.
Right.
Obamacare comes in and says, you know what? You know, it's not perfect, But the numbers game is the numbers game on a national basis. It makes more sense. But the side effects of those, we saw recently that just today or yesterday that more people were leaving their jobs and looking for more jobs.
Right. Switching jobs because they don't worry about losing their health care.
Why?
Because of Obamacare is what you're going to say. Your argument about we require everybody who drives a car to be insured.
Yep.
How is this any more intrusive?
No difference.
We require anybody who could possibly go to the hospital to be insured
as well.
Plane,
car, boat, you better have insurance, right?
Right.
So if you're mechanical, we're going to make you do it.
Organic, why not? Why not require the same thing? Look, no, it makes perfect sense.
Because we make choices as a nation, right, that we want our people to be healthy. We want our kids to be healthy. And when the kids are healthier and we support them, you know, and then from an entrepreneurial perspective, now you can leave your company knowing you can go out and get Obamacare
right.
and have some health care.
Let's talk about weed.
Wait, before we get there, one other thing, okay?
Yeah.
That I like to say that people think is controversial. On the libertarian side of me, I would love to see 70% of government services eliminated.
Disappear.
Eliminated. But that money, just write a check. Just write a check for people rather than playing the game of them coming in, you know, writing
the whole
money.
Bureaucracy.
Right, writing money because you know that's at least 30, if not 50% inefficient.
Right.
If you just took all that money, paid the people who were working in those services and administration half of what they were getting to not work, right? Let them go get
right.
another job, give them their own little, you know, buyouts, and just helicopter drop the money onto all those people. They would end up getting $25,000 or more each. They would have to spend that money. They wouldn't save it because that's the nature of where they're at, right?
Right. That economic strata always spends whatever cash they come in.
Right, right. And so the economy is going to be far better, right?
Is that realistic? Can we really get
rid
of...
Yeah, we could. Yeah, you could, but it's not going to happen, right? I mean, yeah, maybe if I run for president someday, which is never going to happen, which means... But it makes
perfect
sense.
You're having too much fun to get into
politics. Oh, my God. The last thing I need is people...
Right. I mean, who wants that level of scrutiny and who wants...
I've got graveyards. I don't need, not skeletons. I've got graveyards.
So let's go back to weed because you, again, libertarian, and
yeah.
I have certain leanings in that way.
Yeah, I don't.
I never understood why marijuana was illegal versus beer or alcohol, which does far more damage.
Yeah, no question.
But when you look at the damage done to people with
the numbers
are
the
drunk,
numbers.
Drunk driving, and you know, if you're driving and you're high, you're going too slow. That's the problem.
You know, okay, so
on the way to Jack in the Box.
I agree, obviously. But it's funny, right? So when you look, I'm neither Republican or Democrat. Don't give a penny
Same
to either
here,
side, right?
Right?
But when you
That's
look
That's not true. You gave to Orrin Hatch.
Oh, that was 13 years ago.
And then
was,
you gave to a Democrat
in Washington State. That's
right. Those are the only two donations you've ever made.
Yeah, 15 years ago, right? And they were.
By the way, you notice I could find that out like this,
right.
But I can't find out what insider trading is legal.
Right?
Or illegal.
See, now you're on my side, right?
I gotcha.
Remember, you took the other side on the SEC when it came to the corporations.
You're bringing me around.
So anyway, so we decide, right?
So we were talking about should drugs be legal? All the costs for incarceration.
Right. Look, it's ridiculous, first of all.
And you were an independent. You said you don't care about either side.
Yeah, and I spaced what my train of thought was because
right.
I was so excited.
See, that's the problem with weed is short-term memory.
Right.
Write down the...
But then again, on the flip side, I've read that cocaine increases your memory and makes it
easier. Is that true?
Easy.
Oh, that's funny. George Carlin's joke used to be the problem with getting marijuana legalized is no one can remember where they left the petitions. That was his famous line.
Yeah.
So but think about how many people are incarcerated due to pot.
It's ridiculous.
So you would release all those non-violent marijuana
no
offenders.
No question about it. No, I remember what I was going to say. Conservatives, right?
Mm-hmm.
So where the conservatives are really messed up, and the Democrats have their own issue, right? Put aside that it's basically the Tea Party, but conservatives were about conserving principles, right? Conservatives,
mm-hmm.
right? But what they're trying to conserve is not 30-year-old principles. They're still 80-year-old principles that are
right.
so outdated, right? And so conserving the people who are 60 years old that were smoking pot in the 60s,
right?
Right, and the 70s when it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and
right.
you know everybody was getting high, and a lot of it wasn't even illegal. You know, those are where we should be conserving the principles because the people who are in charge now in their 60s, that's the life they were living. What happened to all the people that you know were a little bit older than us that were telling us about how they were going to change the world. Those are the people now.
They all went corporate. A lot of those people went corporate.
I mean, it's crazy.
They're all doing insider trading.
Think about when we were kids. Yeah. Think about when we were kids. Right? Sex, drugs, rock and roll,
sure.
Led Zeppelin, you know, all this stuff. And everybody was going to change the world, sit in, you know, all these principles.
A lot of the rise of the conservative movement, Reagan is a perfect example. That era was a pushback to the extremes of the 60s and 70s.
Well, exactly.
The pendulum swings from one crazy.
Yeah, but they're not conserving what they should be conserving any longer, right? They've
right.
lost track of what a conservative is, right? Now it's like it was 80, 90 years ago that they were trying to conserve when the world has changed.
The world has changed radically. So here we are in 2014. The most recent Supreme Court said gay marriage is now legal to for about 200 million Americans, about 31 states, I think it was, mm-hmm. which is pretty amazing
yep.
that how rapidly that changed.
Gays can get married. You can get it high as a kite, and it's all legal
but
now.
It's only in a hand. Now, the marijuana is only a handful of
yeah,
states.
Yeah, but it's essentially non-criminalized in most others.
In most places, although it depends on
the circumstances, the judge,
the
cop. Yeah.
You and I, as white people who earn a decent living, we're not going to get busted for smoking weed, but if you're an inner city kid, if you're a black kid, your odds of getting arrested for smoking marijuana are much, much higher. The number's something like 1 out of 10 black
men. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and that's clearly not applied even-handedly.
No question.
So the question is, I think people are really surprised. Remember, Biden kind of opened his mouth and forced Obama into this. I don't think 2 years ago anybody expected gay marriage
to
just completely run away.
Oh, the conservatives,
it's
running right past the Republicans.
It's funny watching them sort of try and catch up.
It's craziness, right? And so you would think that they would adapt, but it's ridiculous. If I would ever run as an office, I'd run as a Republican, because conservatively, financially,
you're a fiscal conservative.
Fiscal conservative in a 2014 way. All these things
right.
that I talked about, right? But if they would just learn to stay out of social issues where they make no sense whatsoever.
But that was the original. You know, the original coalition was, you go back to the Reagan Democrats, it was fiscal conservatives, it was the religious right, it was the tax cutters. You put those three groups together.
And in 1984, when you had three TV stations, four TV stations,
you could get away with
that.
Sure.
Worked, right?
Now that's working, I guess. Listen, the immigration, you're down in Texas.
Uh-huh.
The immigration rules, the whatchamacallit, the Republicans, you have certain Republicans
who want to build
that
fences.
Are pushing this. Oh, no, I'm not talking about the far right guys.
Oh.
That there are actually some moderate Republicans who are reasonable on immigration, and they get shouted down by the rest of the party. Yeah, building fences isn't going to do a whole lot
for
anybody.
Oh, they're just so stupid. They don't want to spend. Oh, it's ridiculous, right?
They're going to eventually. I think the Republicans have hurt themselves with the Hispanic voting.
Oh, they're gone. It's gone.
It'll take a generation. Look, the same thing happened with when Johnson passed the Voting Rights Act. The thing was, all right, we just lost Southern whites for a generation.
Well,
turned out to
changed.
Be two generations.
Well, yeah, and it's changed. I mean, with social media and everything, communications is changed.
Much quicker.
Right, and the Republicans just don't get it.
Why is that? Why
you can't get
they can't get the tech geeks to do this for them?
No. They just can't get accepted among themselves, I guess, right? You're not going to get elected because the people who vote in non-presidential elections.
Right.
There's so few of them that it's an
so
order.
So the midterm elections, the Republicans can do
well. Unless the Democrats really get out the vote like they did for the presidential election, you're going to get further and further right. I don't know. Look, I'm not a political pundit. I'll defer to Nate Silver and how it'll all work out. But
well, he's saying the Republicans will take the Senate, and then that tees up the 2016 presidential elections. By the way, Republican Senate isn't the worst thing for Hillary Clinton. I can't think.
Oh no,
she probably is happy with that.
Yeah.
And the only question is, who are the Republicans going to put up against her?
I have no idea. That's the unknown. What's the dude's name?
Chris Christie.
No,
just
no,
what state?
Oh, he was Canadian. He had the dual Canadian.
Rand Paul?
No, not Rand. Oh, I can't believe him. I don't pay close enough attention.
Rand Paul.
He's a Hispanic name.
Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz.
Okay.
Right? So when I go through Washington and he's mentioned as a big name, right? The one thing I hear about Ted Cruz, and I don't know the guy, I don't know anything
right.
about him, is that he's a jerk. everybody hates him. And everybody,
right.
And he,
have
he,
you met him?
No, I've never met him, so this is all secondhand. But all I know is that everybody that I've talked to that knows anybody who works for him, so again, secondhand, right. They've all quit or been fired, and
really?
The turnover is enormous. And this is the guy that, from what everybody says, is most likely to be the Republican candidate.
So you can't build a presidential team if
over
you're,
hate. No, yeah,
assuming that's true. I've never heard that before.
Oh,
that's kind of
interesting. Time in and time out, again and again and again and again.
What's been so fascinating about, look, I grew up a Jacob Javits Republican, and in New York what that means is Javits is a liberal Northeastern Republican, which meant no overseas adventures. That's how Vietnam affected him. Low taxes, balanced budget, but keep the government out of the bedroom.
Right.
So back in the day, that's the closest thing you got to a libertarian in the Republican Party.
Right.
That bit of politics puts me on the far left
right.
fringe today
right.
when that was considered center right 30 years ago.
It's all so extreme now and so polarized. It just doesn't work.
Well, hopefully they'll figure out some. Somebody will figure some way
so we,
to pull it together.
We need a sacrificial candidate to go up there and just blow everything up to get people paying attention, knowing there's no chance of being elected within their party, but just to get the topics discussed.
You know, the closest guy to that was Rand Paul,
yeah, but he's so,
who used to say stuff that the rest of the party would just cringe. It was fascinating to watch that.
But he was so extreme, like gold standard and this and that, that it was just,
right.
he just played libertarian
right.
to
the
extreme.
The hilt.
So he didn't solve problems. He was just as much dogma as anybody else. You need someone who's going to look at everything individually and say, here's the problem, here's the solution, here's how we vetted it. If you don't like it, kiss my ass, because I don't care if I get elected.
Ron Paul is the only guy, and I wasn't a Ron Paul fan supporter, but I was kind of a fan of his, because he's the only guy who would come out and say, we can't spend $1 trillion on these overseas wars that are of choice. And nobody else in the party would say anything like that.
No, they wouldn't. But Rand's problem, you know, they asked me to go on.
Ron, the dad. I'm talking about Ron.
Ron, yeah. Ron.
Rand.
Rand or Ron. Rand's a little bit more.
Center?
Center, but still. Everything
but he's still
was,
out there.
Yeah, but it's all dogma, right? You can't just stick to libertarian dogma, whatever it is, right? Conservative dogma, Democratic dogma. It's the dogma that kills the dog.
And that's the appeal of the guy we were talking about earlier, because he's really a...
No, we don't know.
He's a technocrat. He just, what do we need to do to get the job
that's
done?
That's exactly right. That's
and
exactly.
that's the appeal. And unfortunately, that's a tough guy to get through the... through
well,
the.
That's why Obama's been closer to center than anybody else, right?
Right.
Stays out of the bedroom, do your own thing.
Right.
Right. You know,
begrudgingly came along on gay rights, and it turned out to work.
Yep.
I don't think he expected that to be as
less
of a problem
no,
than
it crazy,
was.
No, it's crazy, but that just says who we are as a nation, you know? And we go through this fight, 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 oh, maybe not, oh, maybe not, oh, maybe not. No, forget it. That's old news.
I have one last quote. I'm afraid I'm keeping you here forever. I have one last quote I want to talk to you about. Is there anything else you want to bring up that we haven't gotten
no,
to?
No, I just, you know, more chances to nail the SEC and tell Mary White should be fired and thrown on the curb. And
well, who are they going to replace her with? They're not going to...
Me.
Yeah, that. Well, again, if I was benevolent dictator. There was a line you said that stayed with me because it's something I really believe in. And this is what I meant by I'm really simpatico with a lot of things you talk about. The most important thing you could do at school... is learn how to learn.
Yep.
I love that line. It's really true. We don't teach kids how to think. We teach them how to regurgitate.
Right.
Talk a little bit about what you meant by that.
Look, the world has changed. When we were growing up, you had to memorize things because if you didn't know them, you had to go find them in the library in a book. Right. Now we live in an open book world. You're on your phone. You're you know, one click away.
Instantaneous
from being
information
able to find something.
About
so,
anything.
Anything, right? So you've got to learn how to not only find it, which is easy, mm-hmm. but you've got to learn how to consume it, understand it, and critically think about it and come to a conclusion. And we don't teach that. You know, I try to do it with my kids. You know, I try to don't just give me the answer. Tell me why.
Important is it to us as a society to raise a generation of people who know how to think about thinking, who know how to...
Oh, it's critical, right? Because if you don't think...
And we're not doing that, are we?
The scary part is, what you would envision if we didn't teach our kids how to think critically is exactly what we have now.
Which is a system that's not working.
Right.
Partisan extremism, ideological insanity.
One step back. The system is working, right? Mm-hmm. The system is working.
Well, everybody is getting food, and most people are getting food.
It's still the greatest country in the world, right? We still, the American dream is still alive and well. It's just we have line items that are ridiculous.
Right.
And so it's not like the big picture. We're in good shape. The country's not falling apart. We have risks, right?
Except for the roads and bridges.
Yeah, depending on where you live, right?
Right.
But those are line items. Those are things that you can find a way to fix if people think critically.
Right.
The problem is people are discouraged from thinking critically because it's not politically correct. It doesn't get you a raise. It doesn't. So people shut up, right? And there's no outlets for people to grow with their ideas like there should be. But to your point, we, as a parent, right? We need to teach our kids to be critical thinkers. We need to get kids in school earlier. We need to recognize the fact that some parents are not going to be good parents. So we help them as much as we can with preschool, like I guess the mayor here is trying to do, right?
Because, guaranteed pre-K.
Good. That's smart, right? People hate it in a lot of respects.
Well, no one wants
smart.
To pay for it, and people accuse the mayor of New York as running a nanny state.
Yep.
But when you have a city, you have real problems. The garbage has to be collected.
Look, it's not where you start. It's where you end up, right? And you can call it anything you want. And I used to, when I was in college, I used to say, look, screw them. If they don't want to do the work, they deserve everything that they get, until I got to the point where I was paying for them. Right. And so
then
it's
a different situation.
Now that I'm paying for them, I'd rather have them go to preschool. I'd rather pay for the preschool because it's going to cost me less.
It's cheaper than unemployment. It's cheaper than drug rehabilitation. It's cheaper
than prison. That's exactly right. So rather than being a fool on my side of it and say, golly, that's just wrong. Right. In a perfect world, it's wrong. But in reality, it is what it is. And how am I going to get to the best point for my kids? How am I going to do the best what I think is for the country? Because not only do you have to learn, I learn. I say it all the time. Other than serving in the military, the most patriotic thing you can do is get stinking rich, right? And pay your taxes. Because that creates opportunity for everybody else. And we can help send kids to preschool so they can learn. So you got to look for the solutions and not just the line items that you fight. And with critically thinking kids, I think we'll get more of that. Where kids just read dogma and regurgitate, we'll have less of it.
Right. We want practical solutions by a generation that understands how to deal with problems and find solutions.
Yeah, I mean, because you've got to think of, in this world, things happen so, information travels so much more quickly than when we were growing up. There used to be an information arb, right, where people didn't know something. I could go to a bookstore, figure it out like that, and learn it before anybody else.
Right.
That information arb is gone because everybody has that information at their fingertips.
It's instantaneous.
So because that information arb is gone, everything happens in real time so much. And so kids, things are going to be affecting our kids so much more quickly than they did us. It's in social media. You know, there's a rumor. You know, the kid said this, the kid said that, that you've got to be able to respond and deal with and understand.
In real time.
And we've got to teach our kids that. I'm looking at helping a business school in Dallas, just changing their curriculum for entrepreneurs completely, 180 degrees, rather than doing the kind of Harvard Business School case study, being able to walk into any business in any situation and understand exactly what that business needs and how to do it and critically think and process information more quickly, because that's the skill set. Learn how to learn how to process, learn what the impact is going to be, and then be able to make a decision about it.
Mark, you're absolutely a delight to sit and talk to here for two full hours.
Has it
really
been 2 hours?
I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.